Well, thank you and good evening if you're from the East Coast, like I am, there you go, or good afternoon if you're from this coast, and I bring you cheery greetings and good weather from Boston, Massachusetts. So, thank you to the Men's Health Caucus as well as the Women's Caucus for organizing this session, and I always appreciate the ability to gain insight from all the previous sessions in Men's Health, so I know this is positioned towards the latter end, so hopefully I can connect some of the points, particularly for people who have been through some of the other sessions. This session is mostly about advocating or conceptualizing advocating for men's health. So as I was telling Michelle earlier, it's a nice little break from the data, and then Michelle will complement it with some of the data. I don't have any formal disclosures. I do have a relationship with Josie Bass and Wiley Publishers with the book on men's health, so I just want to put that out there, but no other formal disclosures. My co-author and co-presenter who couldn't be here today also did not report any disclosures. So we've been working on this concept, and it started as a concept paper, and it's developed into something that I think is more of a connection with the men's health movement that we'll go into a little bit more in detail. So if you're interested, that should be out in the next few months from the American Journal of Men's Health. So a very wordy abstract here. I'm not going to read it to you, and I'm not going to even ask you to read it. There's a lot of stuff there. I'm going to boil it down for you. And you probably have heard this in a lot of the other presentations where men certainly have a lot of health outcomes that are not necessarily in their favor, particularly fewer years of life, fewer quality of years of life. What I'm going to discuss in this is more of the role, is it biology that's causing men to have poor health outcomes? Is it something more in the social determinants? And why do we also tend to agree or accept with these morbidity and mortality statistics? So essentially the purpose is a systematic review of the conceptualization of how attitudes and how gender and gender role conflict kind of play into this whole enculturation of male health, particularly in the United States. I'll let you read that quote. I thought that quote was very meaningful if we look at how we conceptualize men's health in the first place or male health. We tend to see ourselves as big and strong and able and functional in particular, but when you really boil it down and you really get into some of the data that I'll show you some tonight, I promise I wouldn't do too much, we do see that, the naked incompetence. We see that as a result of the health outcomes, and hopefully I can convince you. So the objectives, and sorry for the number ones there, my Mac apparently wasn't compatible with this system. If I can do this in the next 15 minutes or so, hopefully I can show that, the health issues that are impacting males across the lifespan, talk about gender roles and basically how they interact with male health or impact male health. This concept of normative content and comparing and contrasting that with the original concept, which comes from women's literature, in normative discontent. So I'll define that for you and show you how it can be applied. And then, like I said before, kind of convince you, I hope, that how males have been enculturated to accept their outcomes in morbidity and mortality and how females kind of have gone along with it. So as a society, we're kind of viewing male health as normative. And then more importantly, and probably what you're here to hear about, is what are some strategies, what are some approaches, and what are some advocacy issues that you can do in your work, in your line of work. So like I said, the impetus for this study came from an article written in 1984, and it was written by Roden, Silverstein, and Striegel Moore. So if you can't really see what I have up here, essentially what this is saying is cultural norms impact social sexual stereotypes, and of course that leads to attitudes. So we all develop an attitude based upon our interaction with critical things such as media and the messages and marketing campaigns. So this whole process by Striegel Moore was really more about what are the consequences as a result of conceptualizing what is women's beauty, what's women's role within themselves to understand beauty, and what does it lead to? Does it lead to more marketing of products, makeup, body procedures, how you dress? And essentially what Roden and Silverstein and others wrote about was it became norm. It became the norm for females to become discontent with their body. So every woman in Western society is held to a certain ideal that you're told, just as being a woman, a condition of being a woman, a female, that you're not good enough. Okay, so what we did is we took from this article and we said, well, let's kind of look at how morbidity and mortality statistics in males kind of have been viewed over the past century or so. So that's really the goal here. I did steal this graphic from Dr. Ichiro Kawachi, who presented this in a presentation a few years back. And this is just a normal obituary from 2002, so just a normal page, random sampling. So nothing special, but what he did was he looked at just kind of the distribution of who was dying, what their ages were, what their status was in terms of race or ethnicity. And essentially, if you look at what's highlighted here, you can see with the ladies, in particular with the exception of Gerard, they were dying at pretty old ages. And again, I stress this was a random sampling of a newspaper, nothing that he picked out. And you can see that the average life expectancy was pretty decent, 90s, 80s or so. This gentleman over here was about 80 years old, so he actually exceeded the overall life expectancy. If you look at the contrasting statistics from African-American males as well as other people that would be considered minority, very, very different story is told here. 40 years old, 27 years old, you know, even a woman down here, or up here rather, 25 years old. So clearly from Dr. Kawachi's research, not only are we seeing race in, or male-female disparities, but we're also seeing that racial category and racial statistics certainly factor in quite a bit, speaking to the disparities that we tend to see. I like Brad Paisley. I think he's a great writer, great artist. Popular media tends to get the fact that males don't do as well as what they should. So, for example, Brad Paisley wrote about men living fewer years of life. So if you pull out some of the song lyrics, right, I've read somewhere statistics show that a man's always the first to go. So he's been on the Men's Health website, Men's Health Network website. And then the second song here, right, I'm still a guy kind of praising masculinity, but how that relates to risky behavior. So whether it's driving fast, driving a truck, you know, going fast in your truck, having a gun, ready to hunt, kind of these factors that define men, and most of us kind of bop our heads to these songs and we're like, yeah, it's a cool song, but what is kind of the message that's being sent, similar to what was the message being sent to women about their bodies, you know, when they were conceptualizing this other topic? So I'll cite Healthy People 2020. Again, it has its good points and limitations. But the overall overarching goal is to eliminate disparities, improve the health of all groups, and I'll stress that, all groups. And then we saw kind of the reactions to the rest of the nation. So the Mikulski Amendment is a champion for women's health, kind of developed the whole well-woman concept. But it's kind of a gender exclusionary bill. There was no real good counterpart to speak to male health. So there are other things where we've seen, I would call it an attack, for example, by the United States Preventative Task Force on prostate cancer screenings and the downgrading of procedures and consultations. So in summary here, not to the whole talk, but in summary of these points, it seems to be a purposeful exclusion for some particular reason. And in this concept of what is a true public health, what does it mean to have true public health for everyone according to the Healthy People document, we have to consider restating things differently. We have to reconceptualize this and not just accept, men tend to die sooner, that's just normal, it's part of biology, when in fact the story is quite different. So the evidence is only as impactful as the lens from which we view it. So hopefully I can give you a little bit of the evidence here. Sorry, the numbers are a little bit small, but if you look at some of the disparity evidence, clearly you can see more prevalence of issues related to heart disease all the way through Alzheimer's disease, and men tend to have quite a decent frequency as well as relative risk. So these are your odds ratios or basically the ratio between male to female issues. And if I focus on those two things right there, unintentional injuries, otherwise known as accidents, as well as suicide, the rates are even, you know, more marked, more profound. So I highlight these because these are modifiable, right? These are behavioral-based issues. There's very few genetic issues that relate to, you know, driving fast or, you know, gravitating towards guns. Some people would say, well, testosterone makes you more aggressive. You know, the evidence is basically lacking in that area. So I highlight those because, again, the evidence is modifiable or we can work with that. Many of you have probably seen these types of data where in 1920, you know, the age category was relatively, or life expectancy was pretty consistent, and then all of a sudden these gaps started developing. So, for example, we started seeing women living longer because of advances in maternal and child health. We also saw males living fewer years because of the effects of war efforts, for example, in Vietnam and Korea and World War II. But then they persisted, right? So then we started seeing a lot of differences. Dr. Von Holm, who was talking about African-American males' health, really kind of hit a light bulb the other day with me because African-American men are living approximately 10 years fewer years of life, not necessarily quality of life, than white females. So if we look at how gender disparities are marked, but in addition, again, going back to the racial ethnic categories, it's quite an astounding event, I would call it. Some more of the evidence, and this actually comes from Armin's article, as well as some others in the audience, as far as how much is being pumped into the system for prevention. So if you look at cancer rates, right, this is one of the astounding prostate and testicular cancer, you actually have higher rates when you adjust for different factors as compared to breast and cervical cancer. And I throw this slide up very, very judiciously because this is not, again, not about creating a dichotomy between preventing services for women as well as for men. It's about where are we putting our prevention efforts for society health and population health. So overall, I would say look at this, you know, in terms of investments, where do we tend to invest? What messages does that send to people, to our population overall? Additionally, some of the other evidence that we see, and Armin nicely conceptualized this, we do. We see if we don't invest in boys and we allow them to disengage in the classroom because of lack of modeling, for example. So if you look at who teaches kindergarten all the way through almost fifth or sixth grade, typically it's a female, which no problem, very good pedagogy strategies. But males may not connect directly if that female does not consider him in the classroom. So disengagement is already part of something called the boy code. So when he's labeled as being perhaps, you know, disruptive because he doesn't really connect with the teacher, plus other things like the environment might be distracting, well, then he gets labeled, then he falls out of the system, and then we start seeing other issues as a result of that. And then other evidence, obviously men tend to occupy 10 of the highest rates of occupational risky occupations. So if you look at the summary of the evidence here, we do tend to look at things as far as mortality as being normative. Obviously, some of the vital statistics that I presented to you hopefully, again, convince you of that. And again, this is not speaking to issues such as health-related quality of life. This is just, you know, raw data. Whatever it means to you is very individual and different. I would argue and say that these issues misalign with, again, promoting health for all according to our national documents such as Healthy People. So the thesis of this paper is really about, you know, what are the guiding concepts? Is it about biology? Fantastic presentation a couple years ago in Denver from one of our UK affiliates talking about, you know, is the Y chromosome just kind of this time bomb waiting to phenotypically manifest itself, or is it something that's more socially determined? Is it normative content, as we propose in this paper? Is it a combination of both, which most of you are probably saying, yeah, it's a little bit of both. But more importantly, what can be done to improve these outcomes? So normative content is really about, you know, how do we reverse some of these things with respect to gender scripting, right? When a boy or a girl is born, or anybody is born, you're given a certain role, you're given a certain gender script from day one, and we tend to live those things out depending upon your culture and what your culture values, right? So it's very difficult to go against your gender role because, again, there's gender role conflict, and if you're at conflict with your normative gender roles, you basically will have repercussions both from yourself, your family, as well as your society, and that could be everything from bullying and teasing all the way through suicidal ideation. So if we don't discuss this, and I think Dr. Giorgiani mentioned it very nicely last night, if we don't call to action, if we don't actually talk about the lack of a male voice or a male health voice, it won't be said, it won't be done. It's something that will just continue to persist and we'll all accept it. And that goes along with issues, for example, Jean Bonhomme yesterday was talking about, you know, if we teach boys early on to disengage from healthcare, why are we surprised when they fail to act upon it later in life? He used the example of a little boy skinning his knee, get up, big boys don't cry. Then midlife, or not midlife, but in teenage years, you know, you're playing football or sport or something, oh, you got a little concussion, no big deal. But then when you're 50 years old and you have a crushing pain in your heart, it's not anything, it's a little indigestion, I can get away with it. I had a colleague at my university who actually lived that out and he died. So, you know, it's to see it play out is remarkable and sad. So when we look at public health, as we're all involved with, for example, we're really interested in looking at socially just principles. So I would argue we're seeing social injustice kind of play out before us in terms of morbidity and mortality statistics. Wilkins in 2010 was basically just saying in his quote, hey, we're just not very good at doing it. I mean, there's no reason not to be good at doing it. We just don't do it well. And that's referring to men's health. Also, again, to go along with Sal's point last night, right, inaction and basically accepting things is polluting the statistics. It's leading to fewer opportunities to be able to discuss these issues. And it's really about, as Armin was talking about with families, it's really about the strength of your citizenry. It's not necessarily about the individual, right? We do a lot of ecological models and we talk a lot about how can we advance the health of this person in their community. But it's the community that kind of drives our health in the first place, right? And, you know, I won't get into all those types of research. So we need to be able to basically bridge those gaps, and you know, even to the point of talking about males not valuing different parts of their health or not having the voice to value it, can lead to even things like having a weaker military because people are more physically incompetent. So what can be done? You know, if you're in the area of academics, as I am and several of my colleagues, you certainly know that funding is dependent upon the first point here, right? Providing measurable, achievable objectives. So that needs to be one of the first, you know, things that we keep in mind. But also one of the challenges might be, you know, the traditional masculine hegemony. Basically, you know, suck it up, as said yesterday by Dr. Von Hom. Also, expectancy theory. So, you know, if we analyze what is expectancy theory, how do we leverage these models to be able to really reach out to men? What motivates them? But more importantly, what demotivates them? Right? We always talk about, oh, we can get men to do this. Well, what can we get men to do that naturally they do anyway? And looking at some key factors. So, for example, we know that males tend to gravitate towards relationships that are based upon, you know, trust or kind of a fraternity, fraternal model. Also, for example, give some shout out Steve Petty and his outreach in clinic, or not in clinics, but in communities, looking at going to where men will be motivated to go. So, for example, whether it's a community outreach like the Toolbox event, you know, using these terms that men kind of, oh yeah, tools, I know that, or pancakes and prostates that we've been talking about for the past couple of days. So it's important to use these theories and models to be able to do that. If we look at some other issues, you know, definitely planning interventions with these concepts in mind. So if we want a behavior, if we want males to go to the doctor more, if we want males to do different things, support their families, we need to figure out ways to leverage these points here, whether it's their behaviors, how much control they feel they have over their life in the first place. This was a logic model that we planned. I'm not going to go through all of this stuff with you. You can certainly email me if you'd like a copy of it or read the article when it comes out. But basically, my summary to this slide is we need to know where the issues are in the first place. So that comes from our epidemiologic data. We need to know what men do and don't value. So that goes back to some of the previous slides. We have to know what motivates them, like I said before, and what does not. We need to go to the men. So again, reaching out to them instead of saying, come to our men's health clinic. Evaluate. Obviously, we're not going to go anywhere unless we prove what we're doing is actually making a difference. And then again, the thesis of the paper, advocacy, you know, really giving a voice to this. So, for example, I get an NATA magazine through the Athletic Trainers Association, and there's always some great articles about Think Pink and, you know, do things around breast cancer awareness. And you know, I wrote back to this organization that basically has about 35,000 members in the United States, and I said, what about the guys? You know, you watch football games, you see these guys wearing pink tape, and they have pink shoes on and everything. It's all wonderful. It's great advocacy. But you have a 350-pound lineman that's sitting on his aging prostate. And something that's going to kill him while he advocates for a woman in his life is kind of a contrast that I typically see, or maybe it's just me, the way that I conceptualize things. So in summary, and I'll be brief with these, you know, the recommendations are basically we have to promote a lifespan approach. I think Armin brought out some great points about fatherhood and starting from the beginning with a son, for example. We have to iterate the roles of social marketing, so the four P's of product, price, placement, and promotion, right? Men are going to say, well, what do I get for it? So if I go to this event, I might go to a football game. Men's Health Network does some great outreach with the Seattle Seahawks and the Washington Redskins. But, you know, events that appeal to men overall, and like I said, Steve Petty and his work in Oklahoma City has really achieved that, and that should be commended. Approaching things from gender sensitivity, so how do males actually like to receive messages, right? We kind of just superimpose these into these models. So Mike Rovito, my colleague, is, well, you know, talking about cultures and gender culture, not just culture in terms of your ethnicity or your background. Or where do men like to receive messages about sensitive topics like prostate or testicular cancer? Who should it come from, right? Should it come from another male? Should it come from a practitioner? Should it come from more of a social model? And leveraging this with other national organizations. So the Men's Health Caucus, for example, working with the Congressional Men's Health Caucus, and also our national policy, where we have some things to do in the future. We have to update some of these policies as they pertain to the Affordable Care Act. So some final thoughts here, and I'll be brief with them. You know, you can read through the quotes, but I think Dr. Von Hom really hit a lot of these points in some of his quotes, right, talking about weeding a garden. You can't weed half of a garden and expect, you know, a beautiful garden. You have to be able to attend to both features of that. And the second quote here, which I really took from one of the classes that I was taking last year, Sir Jeffrey Vickers talked about public health basically being, you know, this thought about when something has crossed over from being acceptable to unacceptable, that's an actionable item. So I would say that based on the data and some of the evidence that I presented, as well as some of my other colleagues, I would say that the outcomes, as far as what I look at, kind of make me angry. It gets me upset. Armin talked a little bit about it. And I would say that's unacceptable. There's no reason for males to not experience a good, healthy, health-related quality of life. So those are some of the selected references here. And then to stay in time, as well as with the session, so are men from Mars and women from Venus? No, my answer is absolutely no. We're from Earth. You know, I like the title of the session. It's catchy, but we need to remind ourselves of that, and I think that's the key point to take home from this message. Thank you very much for the opportunity.